Good morning, Connecticut. And to our friends across the Sound, it's Director of Public Affairs, John Vokette. Thanks for tuning in to Connoisseur Media's award-winning public affairs program for the people, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. This morning, we're launching a new series called Counting on 2020 Census Segments. That'll begin to bring you loads of information as we move toward April 1st, the day of the big count. Today, we're going to start reviewing why the U.S. Census is so critical to Connecticut this year and how you can learn more about it through workshops being hosted across the region. We're going to speak with CT Data, one of the hosting agencies, about why these workshops are of particular importance to state nonprofits. Then we're going to transition to the subject of hospice and a difficult conversation about hospice for children here in Connecticut. We're going to chat with the CEO of Regional Hospice about how it just launched plans to create only the fifth inpatient children's hospice center in the nation. And we'll close with an important encore of a discussion we first aired a few months ago about the ties between the flu and cardiovascular disease, reinforcing why getting a flu shot is so important and why it's not too late to get your flu shot today if you haven't already done so this season. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Vokette, right after this reminder. Human service organizations across Connecticut are gearing up to help low and middle income residents prepare to file their 2019 federal and state tax returns at no cost through the Volunteer Income Tax Assistant, or VITA, program. VITA will kick off its popular tax filing support programs at sites across the state on January 7th, and at each site, VITA's IRS-certified volunteers will help individuals and families with 2019 incomes up to $56,000. Persons with disabilities and limited English-speaking taxpayers who need assistance in preparing their own tax returns. Federal and state returns are prepared and electronically filed at no charge, along with tax filing help. Taxpayers can learn more about financial literacy support available for them at each organization's site. To schedule an appointment or locate VITA tax assistance sites in your city or town, visit 211CT.org or just dial InfoLine at 211. Well, it is 2020, so welcome to our brand new series, Counting on 2020, our census segment number one for this new year. And we are going to be introducing a brand new acquaintance to the award-winning For the People. We're pleased to be on the line with Michelle Reardon Nold. She is the director of CT Data Collaborative. They are working in conjunction with our friends at the Connecticut Community Nonprofit Alliance and the Connecticut Council for Philanthropy, co-sponsoring a series of workshops for nonprofit organizations throughout January, and they'll be coming up in Middletown, Norwalk, Waterbury, and Hartford. And we're going to talk about those workshops that actually are going to start this coming Friday, based on when we're airing the program, so a week from today as we tape it. And we're pleased to make Michelle's acquaintance. Michelle, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you very much for having me.
So we're here, and the 2020 United States Census is looming. And part of what you're doing, if I understand correctly, is helping to increase awareness and understanding of the importance of the census to Connecticut, as well as playing a role in helping engage people not only in participating in the census, but actually gaining some employment opportunities through the census. So let's first talk about you and CT Data and the role in this kind of collaboration with the Community Nonprofit Alliance and the Council.
Great. Yeah. So CT Data is the designated Census State Data Center for Connecticut. So we serve as a liaison between the Census Bureau and the public, and we help the public find and use census data, but we now have a critical role to play in terms of raising awareness around Census 2020 as it is fast approaching and taking place. It will start in March, but the official count happens on April 1st, 2020, so only a few months away.
Now, tell me a little bit about CT Data. Is this an initiative that kind of came together over the past 6, 12, 18 months ahead of the census, or was CT Data an entity not specifically related to the work that you're doing with the census.
Right. Yeah. No, CT Data, we are a statewide nonprofit. We've been around for several years, probably about 8 years now. Mm-hmm. And our focus is to democratize access to public data and build data literacy skills. So we have a website, ctdata.org, where we publish over 200 public data sets. We also have data-related projects. For example, we make the Secretary of State business registration data available. We also hold lots of workshops to increase the public's ability to their data literacy skills and to build organizational data capacity. But one of our roles is as the Census State Data Center, and that is a designation that we received in the fall of 2018. So our work is now focused on Census 2020, but our work on the census will continue beyond 2020.
Hmm. Well, I'm glad I asked the question and you introduced the answer the way you did, because, Michelle, I think a lot of people, your average citizen here in Connecticut, when they hear the word data, a lot of times maybe they think about, oh, that's something I'm going to leave to somebody else to deal with. whereas as journalists or as scientists or folks involved in government or accounting or things like that, they live in the data world all the time. Tell me a little bit about how CT Data both is working toward helping the non-data inducted Connecticut resident become more familiar with not only how the data you compile can help them, but how they can get into it and navigate it in a way where they're not just like tossing the screen up against the wall in about 5 minutes.
So that is, a focus of ours, and we provide the data in what we say is an accessible format. So, not just available where you want to throw the screen up against the wall, but we offer lots of different tools and online visualizations that enable, people of all skill levels to access and find the information that they're looking for. Mm-hmm. Most recently, the latest census data that came out is called the American Community Survey, and that came out with new 5-year estimates at the end of December. And so we have a tool on our site that allows you to explore that data, to look at median household income across all 169 towns. Mm. You can also look at educational attainment. We display the information on a map so you can find your town and find the data point without having to scroll through a spreadsheet or work in Excel, per se.
Oh, good.
So that is the main focus of ours, is to make it accessible.
Mm-hmm. Have you, in the years that since you've formed here in Connecticut and have become available to everyone, have there been any particular data sets that you have found either through analytics, non-professional or non-data types may be going to them to access them? Or do you have some idea of the kind of data sets that have been most attractive to the least familiar users?
We have population data sets that I know are accessed. So you can check out the population of all 169 towns, population projections for all 169 towns. So that's, information that a lot of people are interested in.
Sure.
Also, we have a lot of municipal town data. So, what's the mill rate in my town? That's always of interest to folks.
I could see where people who might be wanting to even move to Connecticut might be accessing your data from other points on the planet.
Absolutely. And businesses, too, right?
Sure.
Businesses, even when we think about Census 2020, businesses use a lot of census data to decide where to build factories, offices, stores, where to create jobs. They're interested in labor market dynamics. So And that actually is, that's another component that's critical about the Census 2020 is it's not just, there's a lot of users of the data that comes from Census 2020.
Yeah.
Well, including businesses.
Well, let's turn our attention to that and the upcoming workshops. According to your documentation, Connecticut receives almost $11 billion in federal funding for everything from roads and schools to public works and vital assistance programs. And for every person in Connecticut that is not counted in the 2020 census, the state could stand to lose almost $3,000 to other states. So obviously right there is the key nugget as to why participating and being part of the census count is important from the point of the general citizenry, but it is also providing a great opportunity for folks to get work or get work supporting the census project. So to that end, your organization in conjunction with our friends at the Council for Philanthropy and the Alliance are sponsoring a number of workshops that start Friday, January 10th in Middletown and then continue on the 14th in Norwalk, the 16th in Waterbury, and on the 29th in Hartford. Tell us a little bit about these workshops and why you're rolling them out in the way that you are to these various locations.
Sure. And I just want to add, John, we added one more workshop, January 22nd in New Haven. So,
Covered all the bases.
Exactly. So this is a really great partnership that we have with the Nonprofit Alliance and the Connecticut Council for Philanthropy. The Nonprofit Alliance realizes the importance that nonprofits play in terms of helping to get the word out about Census 2020. So they're an integral part of these workshops. But the focus is on nonprofits and how they can integrate Census 2020 information and outreach into their work with residents when they are running programs or, doing the regular service work. But these workshops aren't solely for nonprofits. It can be for anybody who's interested in learning more about the nuts and bolts of Census 2020. So the Census Bureau will be facilitating these workshops, and it will be about an hour long, and it will give an opportunity to answer any questions. How is Census 2020 going to work? What can we expect? How can we inform people who ask us questions? And just be better informed about the whole process.
So in an ideal situation, take XYZ nonprofit in Bridgeport. They're going to come out to the workshop maybe in Norwalk. And what are a few of the things that you would advise the people who are coming to these workshops to be prepared to learn, or maybe some of the questions they should be poised to ask?
So they can learn about when Census 2020 is going to start and how it's going to be implemented this year. It's the first decennial census that can be done online first. There also will be an opportunity to fill it out over the phone, and they'll have language support on the phone to fill it out. So at the workshop, you'll learn about the different ways in which people can participate in the census, when the first mailings will go out. You'll learn about the actual, it's April 1st is when you count everybody in your who's living in your household, including children. So there'll be a lot of information, but then there'll also be opportunities. We know that there are residents of Connecticut who might not understand the importance or might be fearful to answer the Census 2020. So the workshop will also provide an opportunity for nonprofits to be able to better outreach to populations and residents that might not want to participate or might be, concerned about participating.
Good. Well, to ensure an accurate count on the 2020 census, which we've already talked about as being so critically important to Connecticut, we don't want to lose $3,000 per missed person to other states. We don't want to be giving our money that's already on the table to other states and losing out on it. So it's critical to have an accurate count for folks to participate in the census, but representatives of nonprofit organizations throughout Connecticut can learn through these Count Me in 2020 workshops to learn how their organizations and the individuals within them can help every person they serve or work with be counted within the current programs, services, and operations. And those workshops are coming up in Middletown, Norwalk, Waterbury, Hartford, and New Haven, Friday, January 10th in Middletown at MARC Community Resource, the 14th in Norwalk at Fairfield County's Community Foundation, Thursday the 16th in Waterbury at the Connecticut Counseling Centers, we said Wednesday, January 29th in Hartford at the Foundation for Public Giving, and you said on the 22nd in New Haven?
That's right. And yep, at 70 Audubon Street.
Very good. Well, we appreciate
it.
Oh, yes,
just one, on our website, ctdata.org, we have a blog post about these workshops, and also the addresses, dates, times for each of the workshops if folks are interested.
Excellent. Our visit this morning to start this series, Counting on 2020, here are census segments. Michelle Reardon Nold of the Connecticut Data Collaborative, one of the three partners on this project, and one of the co-hosts of the workshop series. Michelle, great to speak with you. I think we may be chatting again as time rolls on through this census period, and thank you for your time this morning. It's been way too long since we were able to have a great conversation with Cynthia Roy. She's president and CEO of Regional Hospice. And on Wednesday, December 4th, Regional Hospice in Danbury revealed its North Star Pavilion, the first children's hospice in the Northeast and the fifth in the nation. This 18,000 square foot expansion was designed by the award-winning architectural firm Roger Ferris and Partners, and we're going to talk all about it today with Cynthia Roy, who's on the line with me. Cynthia, welcome. Thanks for joining us. Hope you had a great holiday, and looking forward to another year of incredible work at Regional Hospice. Man, this is going to be your fifth year anniversary in the what we're still calling the new building, right?
Yeah. Thank you, John, for having me. Yeah, it will be the fifth anniversary. It's hard to believe it's been 5 years already since we've been open.
So let's talk about Regional Hospice as an entity, because even long before this gorgeous new and quite unique hospice center was opened in Danbury, Regional Hospice was working really, really hard to support the hospice movement and all of the people who came to Regional Hospice for support for many years, right?
Yeah, I mean, the organization itself was started in 1983, so it was a really strong and vital organization long before I came along to build the building. But one of the things that I've been in hospice for 23 years, and one of the things that I knew when I came to build the building in 2007 was that we needed to have something like this in this part of the state, that there was really nothing else like it. And so we sought after the process of building it and changing the regulations in the state to make it happen.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's ratchet things out really broad in terms of helping to once again articulate to people who have not experienced it, those families who have not been touched by it, and particularly the people out there who not only may be skeptical about hospice, but who actually may have heard misinformation that makes them think badly or lose trust in what hospice is all about.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a good question. So hospice itself is a service that's provided both under private insurance and under Medicare and Medicaid, that allows patients who have a six-month prognosis to get treatment and services in their home or in the setting that they choose to live in. And often, exactly what you said, John, is correct. People are very scared of the H word. They think that hospice means that you're dying, you have hours and days to live. But often, patients are referred to us long before that point. They are referred to us within 6 to 9 months of their passing, and really find that they wish that they had been, you know, referred to hospice earlier often in their disease trajectory, because they need the support in the home or, you know, in their, you know, their emotional life to get through whatever diagnosis they're dealing with. But people are scared of the H word, right? It's a scary thing to think about death and dying, and we all are going to face it. So it's a tough thing for people to address. But certainly when they're willing to address the onset of an illness, it's very serious. And then the subsequent news, usually people are hearing that treatment isn't working. Hospice is usually a godsend for them. It's an opportunity to get support services that they weren't even aware were available. So when people usually embrace the concept and they allow us into their homes and we have the privilege of caring for them, they find that it makes a huge difference in terms of the support that they need and the family needs primarily as well.
Mm. Do you think that people generally may not promote hospice, those who have used it, those who have been part of it, those whose lives have been enriched along with that of their late loved ones? Do you think that that they don't talk about hospice because once that person has passed, you suddenly kind of switch gears into that new chapter of mourning and all of the activities and business around the death of a loved one? And at that point, they just mainly want to kind of turn their attention in a different direction. So they're not out there really doing a lot of promotion or sharing about the great experiences that they've had.
Yeah, no, I've actually found the opposite. We do a patient satisfaction survey for caregivers when the patient has passed, and 95% of family members say that they would refer, regional hospice to their friends and family after the service they've been, they've gone through. People actually, I get hundreds of letters from families who are extremely appreciative of the service that they received. And what I always hear, the theme is that people had no idea what hospice could provide and are surprised and amazed at the support that they got through this illness, because they didn't know what to expect. If you haven't been through a loss before and you haven't cared for someone close to you who's critically ill, you don't even know the beginning of what to do in the everyday life in terms of just bathing, dressing, and feeding, let alone medication administration, which can be extremely scary for a lot of family members. How do you draw up a syringe out of a bottle? That's really frightening to somebody who's by themselves at home, with no one else to call, and to have a support service available to you 24/7, I think has been invaluable. And I think when families have used the service, they rave about it and they continue to tell friends and family about it long after their loved one has passed. Certainly one of the things that we work on is we support families for well over a year after the loved one has passed through the bereavement support. So often people might say, oh, I don't need that service right away. I have lots of friends in the area who are here to support me. But they might find a holiday becomes really difficult, or friends and family leave when they move on to other things. And the focus of their loved one's illness is not forefront for them. And to be able to have somebody else to be able to support them through, this grieving process is really pretty pivotal. Mm-hmm. So my experience has been that people, once they've used hospice services, they really are open to it. Sometimes getting there, though, John, is the hard part. People struggle with the word, because I think historically people have thought of hospice, as I said, days and weeks before death, or sometimes hours. And I think also people are really scared of the medication, morphine, and they think automatically that hospice staff are going to come and administer morphine to their loved ones and somehow speed up the process of their passing, when in fact it's actually the opposite. Morphine is the gold standard in pain management, and actually it's used even when women have babies, we use morphine, but we just don't call it that. It's a different medication. Mm-hmm. So people are very afraid of those words, and I think that we really try hard to educate and demystify those words so people understand they're not as scary as one might believe.
Mm. Do you think people generally think a hospice is for the last few hours or days?
Oh, yeah. We've done studies on this, and we have found that most families believe that and are kind of surprised. I had a lady who was in my center who was 46 years old, and when her family let their friends know that she was in the center and she was on hospice, they said, oh, is she awake? Can she even talk to us? Can she communicate? And can we sit down with her? Well, this lady was, cruising around our building, eating wonderful food and having friends at her bedside and really enjoying those moments with her loved ones. And wasn't, in her last hours and days, and in fact lived with us for 4 months in our center beautifully, when had sleepovers with her family and really had such an amazing end to her life. And it was really a celebration of her life. And that's what we really try to focus on, both within the center, but also for patients who are at home who wish to remain at home until the end. We are really about living fully until you die. It's not about dying. It's about living. And I think that that's the misnomer people have about hospice sometimes, is that, oh gosh, you're imminently dying. And that's not necessarily the case.
Yeah.
If it is the case, you know, our goal is to make somebody as comfortable as possible and provide the support to their family through that process.
I don't have a large circle of acquaintances who are involved in hospice, especially to the extent you are, Cynthia Roy. But I think it was you that told me back when we met, you know, 7, 8, 9 years ago, that occasionally someone who goes into hospice actually becomes well and leaves hospice to go on and live a very productive and fulfilling rest of their lives.
Mm-hmm. That is actually true. It's a very small percent, but we do have a number of people that we call them our graduates,
mm-hmm.
that haven't had a lot of attention, and maybe they're elderly and they're not getting a lot of visitors, and all of a sudden our hospice team is coming in regularly and they're getting tons and tons of visitors, and they perk up and they do really well and they graduate. I had a 110-year-old lady graduate from hospice.
Mm.
Took a break for a year, traveled to Florida, did very well, and then came back on our hospice program when her disease progressed. Mm. She was very lucky. She found herself in a situation where she had a remission. But that doesn't always happen. But when it does, those are great experiences. And, you know, being on hospice is very different than regular home health. Regular home health care, you can't travel, you can't go on vacation, you can't do any of that. On hospice, you're allowed to travel, and we encourage that. So we have lots of people that go to Disney with their grandkids. And we call ahead and make arrangements with a team in Florida and make sure that they're being followed by, you know, a hospice team in Florida. And you can do all of that on hospice, which people don't realize that with regular home health, you're very limited in home health care in terms of having to be homebound and having to not leave the home. And that's not the case for hospice at all. And that's one of the wonderful things about the Medicare hospice benefit.
We're going to take a quick break, and we're going to come back and talk more with Cynthia Roy, President and CEO of Regional Hospice. Stay with us. Do you love Connecticut? If you do, there are hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots organizations that I'd love to have your support. You can learn about many of them through Love CT. Just go to our radio station website, hit the event guide tab, and click on to Love CT to help the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm John Voquette, your public affairs director here at Connoisseur Media. We'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. Well, we started talking about the U.S. Census earlier in the program, but if you want to learn about homelessness in your community and make a difference, the Connecticut Coalition to End Homelessness and its members are looking for volunteers to participate in this year's point in time count on the evening of January 21st and in the Youth Count and Outreach Project, which is going to take place the following week. Volunteers will attend a brief training for this special census before hitting the streets in teams to identify how many people are living in emergency shelters or in places not meant for habitation. If you'd like to learn more and help, just visit cceh.org/volunteer. Thanks for sticking with us. We're back with Cynthia Roy, President and CEO of Regional Hospice. Well, I know you mentioned the morphine stigma, but are there any other misconceptions that you find people have about hospice that really keep you up at night because you know that those misconceptions may be preventing them from either supporting or referring a loved one to hospice care?
Yeah, I think there's a couple. I think people are very private, and I think sometimes they struggle with having what they would term as, you know, strangers in their home. I think that's sometimes a very scary thing for people. But I think once they realize, you know, a nurse can come in and, you know, rearrange the medications and change the protocol with a physician and get the medications into a better organized schedule, that a person actually feels better and that their loved one actually wants to get up and get out of bed, they're surprised by that outcome. So I think that once people can get over that initial, like, oh, I don't know if I want people in my home feeling, which is tough, it really, they find that it's a much bigger benefit than the drawback part. And that's also one of the reasons why I built the center, so that if people don't want people coming in and out of their home and they aren't sure about their loved one being in their home, they have this center as an option for them if they choose to place them with us in the center. And the other kind of surprise about the center is that patients don't always die in our center. Patients come into our center for respite. They come in for symptom management. If they have a particular symptom that's been difficult, we don't send patients to the hospital. We bring them into our center for symptom management. And then we bring them home when they feel more comfortable. And that's really pretty common. And that's been a huge relief to a lot of our families where they don't want to go 911 to the ER again. And but they want their loved one comfortable. But they're concerned because their symptoms are such that maybe they're difficult to manage at home. So that's been a big surprise, I think, in terms of having that as an option. And I think the other piece too is just, you know, being open to having, you know, different people in your, you know, your medical care. It's such a difficult system now to navigate healthcare. And the nice thing about hospice is that we navigate it for families. So we can, you know, predict and say, these are the things that are happening. And we try to really be proactive in preparing families for the what ifs, the things that are coming down the pike so that people are aware and comfortable. And people have gotten so out of the habit of having healthcare providers give them those options and, you know, prepare that landscape for them that they are kind of surprised and very relieved that they have a support team available.
Yeah.
The other thing that's really nice is at 2 o'clock in the morning, if someone is really, you know, nervous and they're not sure about how to care for their loved one, they can get a hospice nurse 24/7. So at 2 o'clock in the morning, a hospice nurse can come out to their house and get them comfortable. And having that 24/7 availability is really invaluable.
Well, certainly one of the what ifs that no one is ever prepared to deal with is the what if when they find out that a child or a young person is diagnosed with some sort of a critical or fatal illness or condition. Mm-hmm. And that's where North Star Pavilion comes in. This is just, you know, it's incredible to think that there's only 5 centers like this in the entire country, and you're sitting in one right now here in Connecticut. Mm-hmm. This was a long time coming, but is quite a necessary service, and really, I have to imagine, makes all the difference in the world when parents and loved ones are facing that most horrible diagnosis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the worst words a parent can ever hear, is that there's nothing more they can do for their child or that the treatment isn't working. Connecticut is an unusual and thankfully a good state in that we allow in the state of Connecticut children to be on treatment for their illness simultaneously as they can be on a hospice program. And that's a pretty amazing service, because what that does is it allows families to get to know our service providers early on in the, you know, critical illness of their child. So a child may be diagnosed with a, you know, a life-limiting illness that could, you know, they could live with for a year to a year and a half, and they're getting treatment perhaps to prolong their life, but they can be on hospice simultaneously. So we will provide support in the home as well as the support they're getting from their medical provider. And we work in tandem with them to do that. Regional has had a pediatric program for many years. In fact, we were one of the only ones that did early on, probably 12 or 15 years ago, we started a perinatal hospice program. And that's very unique. And that is for mothers who know that their baby is going to be born with a life-limiting illness. They choose to carry the baby to term, and then the subsequent death or illness of the child when the baby's born. Believe it or not, many, many of those babies that we've walked hand in hand with families in that delivery process actually end up living much longer than ever anticipated, and usually live, you know, 3 to 6 to 9 months after the baby's born, and get really pretty amazing and precious time with that baby. And it actually makes the grief process entirely different, because they get to know their baby. And while it's extremely brave and difficult for people to make those decisions, they do. And to have a support system in place that allows them to do that, I think, is a gift. And so we're very proud of that program. But we also take care of, unfortunately, a number of children who are born or who or find out that they have a life-limiting illness and they're, you know, in 3, 4, 5 years old, up to 18. And every day we have a fair amount of kids on our program at home who are getting pediatric hospice support. And we have a unique and amazing pediatric team that manages those kids. But when I built the building 5 years ago, I had always intended to have children in the center, and we've had a number of them. But we found that really kids need their own space. And even though our building is incredibly child-friendly and it has a playground and it has things that nobody else in the country has, to have its own unique patient care unit is something pretty special. And we're modeling our program very similarly after a program in Phoenix called Ryan's House. And that program has been around for 18 years, and it was started by a family whose child was born with a life-limiting illness and, in fact, just passed away last year at the age of 18, Ryan. And their goal was to provide a place for terminally ill children to go, both for respite, but also for symptom management. So the goal of the North Star Pavilion is to provide respite to terminally ill children as well. So if mom or dad need to get away and haven't had a break in a really long time, the North Star will allow them to come and stay there for 2 or 3 days, up to 5 days, at no cost to their family members, and the family can get a break. Mm-hmm. And that's really important because in Connecticut, and in fact, the whole Northeast, there's nothing like this, which is kind of shocking in this day and age. And we have lots of families currently who would love to take part in this service because, you know, their child is critically ill. They don't feel comfortable leaving their child with a babysitter or someone who's not medically trained, and this allows them the opportunity to do that. The unit also will serve as a place for children to pass in as well. And one of the things over the years I've heard over and over again from family members who have had children who've died on our service is that they thought they wanted their child to die at home. That was very important to them. And in fact, after the passing of their child, they'll often say to me, I wish she didn't die at home because I want to remember her living in our home and not dying in our home. Mm-hmm. And often that's the case for siblings too, where you've got other little kids in the house and they'll always remember their sibling dying at home. And the nice thing about the North Shore Pavilion is they can leave the death behind someplace else and they can always remember their child living in that house.
Yeah.
And I think that families, if you've never been through this before, families don't know what to anticipate. And this is something we've seen as a common issue.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, Cynthia, because the kind of the cliched image that we see so often in TV shows and motion pictures and theater is the child has passed, and then for months or even years, the room is left untouched, or they can't stand to go into the room, or they never really use the room again. And it does serve as that kind of reminder within the household. So I'm glad you brought that perspective up about the child passing in the hospice environment, particularly in such a unique environment as the North Star Pavilion, which you just opened in December earlier this month. So before we let you go, the last thing we want to leave people with is a kind of a user-friendly way or an easy way for them to learn more about hospice. And you've developed this wonderful video series that launched about a year and a half ago, maybe almost 2 years ago, I guess, including this latest one, Emily's Last Wish. Let folks know about your video series, and then we'll say farewell for now.
Emily's Last Wish is a story of a young girl. Her name was Corinne, but we call her Emily. And the purpose of this piece is to talk about her last wish being that we build a unit specifically for kids like her. So we've done an award-winning commercial campaign. It's an animated campaign, and we actually have our fourth commercial coming out in January. We work with a well-known artist, CJ Settlemyer, who did Beavis and Butthead and another really interesting character. He's been on SNL, as well as John Calhoun, and they're the animators who've done these pieces. So Emily's Last Wish is a rendition on one of our commercials that's on our website. You can either go to emilyswish.org or regionalhospicect.org to see it. Mm-hmm. But it really tells the story of Corinne and the things that she wanted to do in her last days with us in the center. She passed in the center, and why it's so important to have the North Star Pavilion built in Connecticut to be one of only 5 in the country and really the only one in the entire Northeast, which I think is an incredible thing to have for our community and the surrounding states around us. But I wish the people would go on and see the animation, and please share it, because I think you rarely see animation around these topics. And I think it really takes very heavy topics that we all are going to deal with day in and day out. It's all different stories. It's a spouse story that's coming out in January. It's a children's story. It's children who are caring for an elderly dad, and tell sort of the funny tales around what it's like to care for an aging parent and make light of it in a really, I think, meaningful but also powerful way.
Excellent.
So I encourage people to take a look at it and share it, because really we all can relate to these issues on a variety of different levels.
regionalhospicect.org is the website to go. Our guest this morning, Cynthia Roy, president and CEO of Regional Hospice. As we heard earlier this month, they unveiled plans for the North Star Pavilion, the first children's hospice in the Northeast and only the fifth in the nation, as we heard from Cynthia, with plans to open in what you said, early 2021, Cynthia?
2021, yes, that's our goal.
Excellent. Well, we thank you for all the work that you and your staff and all your incredible volunteers and supporters do at Regional Hospice, and wish you luck with this. I'm sure we'll be talking again soon. RegionalHospiceCT.org is where you need to go for all the information. And Happy New Year, Cynthia, and we'll talk to you again soon. Well, we are just approaching Halloween, and that's when a lot of health professionals tell you to say boo to the flu and get your flu shot. And, you know, certainly we've heard a lot of reasons why you don't want to get the flu. You know, it is a dangerous thing for people, particularly those in compromised health conditions. But we're very, very excited now that the fall flu season has started to be talking with a healthcare professional who is going to discuss some research that's causing more concern because it suggests the flu virus can trigger a heart attack or stroke weeks later for those with certain risk factors. I'm on the line right now with Dr. John Dinkler. He's with consulting cardiologists to talk about the connection between flu and the heart. Dr. Dinkler, great to meet you. Thanks for joining us on the program.
Thanks for having me.
So you've got quite a practice there at at consulting cardiologists. Tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, so we are a pretty large practice here throughout Central Connecticut. We have about 13 cardiologists and offices throughout about 9 locations in Connecticut, stemming from Wallingford up in Hartford and around that area. It's a great, great growing practice. We actually joined forces. There are two individual groups that joined together here in January to form the new consulting cardiologists, and it's really exciting. It's enabled us to expand our services and expand our cardiovascular care across the state.
Yeah, and I see that you're still independent, not directly affiliated or subsidiary of hospital, but I imagine all of your physicians are affiliated with numerous hospitals, so you've got quite a reach in that respect as well.
Absolutely, yeah. So we have plenty of our offices where we perform, you know, our testing and a lot of our cardiovascular workup, and we see patients on a regular basis. And then, if any of our patients are admitted to the hospital throughout the state of Connecticut, we also have privileges at a few different hospitals so that we can make sure that we coordinate that care in both inpatient as well as on the outpatient basis.
Great. Well, we hear so often these sad stories, which so many can be prevented of people dying or becoming really, really sick from the flu and having lasting impact from it. Can you just kind of give us a quick refresher on what the flu virus is and talk about some of the most serious complications of the flu?
Absolutely. Yeah, so flu or influenza is a virus that can infect the tissues in the nose, the throat, the mouth, in and around the lungs. It's typically transmitted by respiratory droplets. So people cough, they sneeze, they talk in close quarters, and they can transmit the virus to other people. And then it can cause anywhere from mild symptoms to pretty severe illness. The milder symptoms are typically the body aches and pains, little stuffy nose, runny nose, cough, fevers, chills, body aches, all those kinds of things that you would associate with even sometimes the common cold. But it can also get pretty serious for a lot of people as well, developing into, you know, things like pneumonia and pretty severe respiratory illnesses and other complications.
Yeah. Can you also clarify the information around the types of flu there are? Because we hear that every year when they're deciding to formulate the flu vaccine, they'll put components of some but not all of the influenza that is circulating around the globe, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah, so two major types of the flu virus. There's influenza A and influenza B. And typically what we see most commonly is various types of influenza A that get transmitted broadly. But when they develop the vaccine, they're doing a little bit of guesswork and a little bit of projecting, trying to figure out what they think is going to be the most common types that are going to transmit illness from year to year. So it's a really complicated process that they try to go through to kind of look back and look forward to see how to attack the virus from a vaccine perspective to keep people safe throughout flu season.
Yeah. Well, we know that flu can lead to pneumonia and other serious respiratory issues, and taxing the respiratory system obviously has its immediate implications on the cardiovascular system. But tell me about when you started becoming more concerned about cardiac complications related to the flu.
Yeah, so it definitely can have a wide-ranging effect on the body, including the cardiovascular system. So not only can the virus itself lead to kind of broad-scale inflammation and strain on the heart and the rest of the cardiovascular system, but then people with cardiovascular disease, when they get the virus, can have more complications. So that general inflammatory process can set up a lot of problems for cardiovascular patients, leading to things like heart failure, inflammation of the heart muscle. That infection, if they do develop a pneumonia, that inflammatory process can lead to a bloodstream infection, which can create more problems for the heart muscle, heart valves. So it goes both ways. Not only for people that get the virus, it can create increased complications with cardiovascular disease, and then people who already have disease, it can be more serious for them than somebody who would otherwise be healthier, just because they're set up to have more of these complications with that systemic response.
So when people are being advised to get a flu shot, those who's in coordination with their physicians, individuals with heart disease are really kind of critically prime candidates to get a flu shot every year.
Absolutely. Yeah, those are the, prime people who absolutely every fall should be lining up to get their flu shot because certainly everybody should be getting their flu shot from young to old. But especially at the top of the list are people who are vulnerable, people with diabetes, asthma, COPD, emphysema, some of those kind of lung and respiratory issues, people who have had heart attacks and heart failure, diabetics. Those are prime populations that really need to focus on protecting themselves from the flu, because it can be very dangerous for those people if they do contract the virus.
Hmm. Well, taking it to the next step with your patients and your patients in your practice that already have cardiovascular issues, are there any significant challenges involved in managing flu patients that have heart problems?
Yeah, so I think, in terms of there's the general maintenance of cardiovascular health and prevention that we would hope for anybody throughout the flu season. So making sure that they are, being careful with being in contact with sick people, washing their hands, covering their cough and their sneeze, general hygiene principles, but also taking their medications regularly, making sure they take, all the medicines for their heart, their blood pressure, their cholesterol, maintaining their health and good cardiovascular health, which includes, hydration and proper eating and proper exercise and movement. All of those things are really important in general, but especially for our cardiovascular patients to stay in top health to prevent illness in the flu season.
Mm. Is there any kind of industry studies within your area of specialty that indicate The percentage of people that have existing cardiovascular problems that are still reticent to get the flu shot?
That's a great question. You know, I'm not, I actually don't know of any off the top of my head that say, you know, this is the percentage of people that are, you know, scared or concerned about getting a flu shot within the cardiovascular population. I know statistics are, you know, wide every year across the CDC that publishes data on the flu and how many people get infected every year. About anywhere between 5 and 10% typically get infected. It can be a little bit lower and a little bit higher depending on the severity of the flu season. But every year we know that patients who get the vaccine do much better in terms of either reducing the illness completely or reducing the intensity and duration of the flu, and that absolutely applies to cardiovascular patients. So I recommend for all my patients to get the flu shot, and I try to walk through any of their reservations about getting the flu shot, because it's an extremely important public health measure for the population.
Now, whether a person has had the flu shot or not, sometimes, as you mentioned, if they get the flu shot, they could still get the flu. It might be the effects may be reduced because of the flu shot. But for those that are feeling flu-like symptoms, whether they've had a shot or not, how impactive is something like Tamiflu?
Yeah. So what you're referring to is the antiviral Tamiflu, which can be given for patients who test positive for influenza, or we get concerned that they have influenza-like symptoms, to try to diminish the duration and intensity of the symptoms. So it does. You know, if you start to get those symptoms, it's really important to see your doctor. Obviously, you know, practicing certain measures again is really important, like avoiding contact with sick people, trying to stay home from work, work from home, stay hydrated. But also contacting your healthcare professionals to get evaluated if the symptoms are severe, so that they can test you and get you that Tamiflu if you need it, which then will help reduce the intensity and duration of the influenza illness. Yeah. So it's really really important.
Okay. We kind of joked at the beginning of the show about this new kind of say boo to the flu, and Halloween is the new Thanksgiving when it comes to getting the flu shot. I remember when I first started getting them now a quarter century ago or more, and getting them loyally every year, and I don't believe ever getting the flu, or if anything, getting a slight touch of it at one or two points in that quarter century. Back then, when I first started, it was, you've got to have your flu shot. You know, Thanksgiving was sort of the target time. Now it's Halloween. It seems to be creeping earlier and earlier in the year. So as we talk about this here at the end of October, we are sort of in prime time for flu shots, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. No, now really, this month is the perfect month to be getting in to your local pharmacy, your physician, wherever it is that you can get your flu shot. October is the month to get it done. Obviously, any time is adequate here in the fall, and obviously even beyond in November, December. Continue to, if you haven't gotten it, it's important to get it. I got mine early as a healthcare professional because I have to do that before I start seeing patients. But certainly now is the prime time to get in and get vaccinated.
Great. Any last words of advice on when people might need to see a cardiologist or what they might need to look for in their own health landscape to talk with their doctor about a referral?
Yeah, absolutely. There are certain symptoms that may prompt your primary care physician to make a referral to a cardiologist. So people that have shortness of breath or any type of chest pain or chest discomfort, especially exertional types of discomfort, really important to be evaluated by your doctor and may require a referral to a cardiologist. other certain symptoms like palpitations or rapid heart rates are really important to see your provider. And then if you have a strong family history or other medical conditions that put you at risk for cardiovascular disease, things like diabetes and high blood pressure, high cholesterol, strong family history, and obviously smoking is a big risk factor. We wish that smoking would go away, but it hasn't yet. And so those are all really important things in terms of risk factors that may make your doctors want you to see a cardiologist. And in terms of overall cardiovascular health prevention, like anything, prevention is the key. So leading a healthy life, making sure you eat properly and move your body and exercise is really important in overall cardiovascular health.
How do people learn more about you and your practice?
We have a website, www.consultingcardiologists.com. People can come and learn about our group of great cardiologists and practitioners throughout the state of Connecticut, would definitely recommend people look us up there.
Great. Super to meet you, Dr. John Dinkler, with us this morning from Consulting Cardiologists, joining a legion of healthcare professionals who are already concerned about the oncoming flu season, which could be record-breaking, as well as relatively new research that's causing even more concern because it's suggesting the flu virus can possibly trigger a heart attack or stroke weeks later for those with certain risk factors. We appreciate you chatting with us this morning, Dr. Dinkler. Best of luck with the practice, your new office opening in Cheshire next year, and we hopefully will talk to you again. Thanks. You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for an issue, a guest, or a PSA relevant to the audience and community served by our radio station, you must make a request for consideration in writing to me via email at john.voquette@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file detailing the many critical community and state issues addressed on For the People can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford or on our station website. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Join us again this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. And don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.